the first question I always ask anybody who's possessed, like, hey, how do I find a deal? I'd be like, well, what is a deal? And what's a deal to you? What does it actually look like? So you know what you're looking for.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. We're here today with Tarl Yarber. Ryan, what's up, man? We just had an amazing conversation with Tarl.
We did. I've known Tarl for about 8 years or 9 years or so. He was the first one I met in Seattle, and he got me into the market here and got me networked. And I think today, not only are you going to hear about his flipping business and how he's transitioned to buy and holds, but you're also going to hear about how to be like a master networker in your market, and also a great event that he puts on every year that I've met a ton of great connections at.
Incredible. Yeah. If you're a fan of Bigger Pockets, you've definitely heard his name. He's all over the place. So excited to get into the conversation.
All right, let's dive in.
Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Today, we have an incredibly special guest that's going to talk a little bit more about the active side of real estate. Tarl Yarber is a recovering house flipper with over 600 single-family home residential properties purchased, rehabbed, and resold over the last 10 years. He's also the CEO and founder of Fixated Events, Fixated Capital, Fixated Funding, and Limitless Expo, which we'll hear about later. Tarl and his team are considered experts in the investment industry, specialize in systems. He's been on the Bigger Pockets podcast twice. He's got a massive YouTube channel, and he's a big video contributor for the Bigger Pockets YouTube channel. So Tarl, your name is all over the real estate industry. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Tate. What's up, Ryan? I haven't seen you in a while, but I remember the first time I met you. It was in Seattle at one of my house flips, actually.
We went to Starbucks as well, right on Aurora Avenue, which I believe is no longer in business anymore. So,
good times.
Yeah, you helped me. I was just off the plane, new into Seattle, and I wanted to get into the Seattle market, and you were deep in the Seattle market flipping houses before flipping houses was cool. So it was awesome to meet your team, and it's been awesome to see you guys grow and put on some awesome events. And I got to say, your events are the best, and I've gotten connected to so many people because of your events, which we'll talk about later in the show. But anyway, we want to talk about how your flipping business has gone and how the heck you've done over 600 homes, the systems, the processes, and all that stuff. But man, it's really good to see.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Well, more importantly,
no.
When I met you, Ryan, you were flipping a house or two in DC area, and I remember you syndicating or something like that, a house, and I was like, this guy's dumb. Why is he doing that? And but it always stuck with me. Like, I just got to say this, right? It always stuck with me that you syndicated a house, and because I'm like, I would never do that. But it also, like, I from perspective from the outside, I'm like, oh, that made it to where you always are thinking of syndicating, always thinking of syndicating, which then led you to where you are now. If I had to say that from the outside looking in, if you would have done what I did, which is private money and everything, you might have not ever gotten where you are with Spartan. So maybe I'm the one that should be listening to you on everything.
Yeah, that's some serious perspective. Yeah, I didn't really think about that. I mean, it's funny looking back, we actually raised like 150 grand in a syndication for a house flip. And at the time it felt right. And looking back, it's kind of funny to look at, but yeah, we just got so used to just doing them. I think we've done like 29 syndications now or something like that. So, well, that's great.
That's excellent. Well, Tarl, it's funny to see that you started in 2012. I bought my first rental property in 2012. You're about 590 something houses ahead of me. So can you walk us through your history and sort of what that looked like in terms of your first deal through your 600th?
I can tell you, I got started in 2005. The short version of that is that I went to a sell-a-thon, basically a whole bunch of big speakers and, like the whole like carrot to drag us all in there because they had Tony Robbins. They had Donald Trump actually speaking in 2005. They had a whole bunch of other people. And then I go to this massive conference in LA, pre-GFC, global financial crisis. And these people were just selling stuff on stage, never seen it before. And I ended up buying a course on how to wholesale real estate. And it was called How to Turn $10 into $10,000 in 30 days or less. And I needed $10,000 because I also bought a different seminar right before that that I needed to pay for. So I bought this one, which got me into wholesaling real estate. And I did that, got a few deals underneath my belt. My third deal, wholesaling, it was actually a double close, which is where you tie up a contract with the seller, and then you get a different contract to sell that same property with a buyer, and then you close both at the same time, a simultaneous close. It's a little different these years. You can't do it exactly the same way as I did it back in the day, but made $100,000 on that one deal, and that was 2006. And then I never did it again until 2011 because I hated it every moment of it. I was only doing it because I was broke and I wanted money. Then I got, believe it or not, I actually got into financial services. So I was not a broke 21-year-old anymore. And then I got into financial services and taught 40-year-olds how to, not lose all their money until I got out of that in 2010-ish, and then went full-time into real estate again in 2011.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The conference that you went to was like, it was one of those like run to the back of the rooms, out your 100%. Card. So, it's funny, like those are kind of like not, they're like banished now or whatever people talk about. But like it worked for you. I mean, you went to the back of the room, you paid the big money and you made a bunch of money and then you got hooked.
Oh, this lady who had an overhead projector out and was showing overhead I don't know anybody listening to this, even if they know what that is, depending on how old you are. And she was showing, what are those things called? The overhead projector, clear sheets of checks that she had from wholesaling real estate, $10,000 check, $15,000 check, I'm like, all right, well, I guess this works. So, I might as well give her $900 for the CDs and books at least, and then go learn how to do this. So
the that's how I did. Do you still have the CDs?
No, I don't. I couldn't even find them if I looked, but,
there's something I want to sort of touch on there. And that's for anybody listening, I get this question a lot. It's like, where should I start? It's education, educate yourself, read some books, listen to podcasts, go to some conferences or worst case scenario, a guru seminar, because it'll get your foot in the door. It'll get you started and get you thinking about real estate and all the possibilities, right?
Absolutely. But honestly, there's a lot of BS out there though. So just be careful, vet it. If somebody else is doing a great job at it, find out why. And there's a lot of stuff you can learn for free out there. It's just more taking that first step. I had to take that first step because there's a longer story there that I don't need to get into, but like I was highly motivated I had the fire to my feet. And versus if you're comfortable making hundreds of thousands, you're probably not going to go door knock at 110 degree heat in Sacramento like I did. So, because you don't need to. So,
right. And I think the big redeeming quality, Tarl, is that you take action and like you encourage and you promote that. And I respect that a lot of people just like, it's like ready, fire, aim. That's like your kind of approach. And then there's ready, aim, fire. And then there's ready, aim. And people never take action, pull the trigger, right? And so you're kind of out there like encouraging people to kind of take that first step, which I have always appreciated. I went to one of your meetups and it was like, I think the intent was like a 90-day plan for people where in 90 days, you're going to do a deal to get going. Cause I mean, that's where you start really learning. And can you kind of speak to that? Like somebody who's maybe they are making a great salary and they don't want to take their first step, but they realize that maybe there is more in real estate and they're just kind of afraid to take that first step, but they know they want to be active. Like, what would you say to those people?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's really just making that decision of, are you going to be an active investor or a passive investor? There's plenty of opportunities to invest passively out there that I'm sure this podcast has talked about many times. And so for the sake of activity, it's, if you're going to go active in real estate, and what active reality, like in a investor terms, is like, you're the operator, you're going to go out there and actually like operate the deal, find the deal or work the deal or whatever it is. Day to day, property manage the deal, which I don't suggest, but whatever. And you want to go be physically touch it, look at it, taste it, hopefully smell it, maybe. Then in that scenario, like why? I would just say that, like, why do you need to? Because you watched enough HGTV that you thought it'd be cool. We're gonna knock down some walls because it's not all glamorous. Like if you're gonna flip or buy single family or multifamily and operate it, there's a lot involved in there to be able to be good at this business. But the only reason I'm saying why is that like, you don't want to go partway through it and realize, wait, I shouldn't be doing that. So if you have a mission to like replace your income or to go full time, or to, you want to be able to quit your job and make all your money in real estate, then, you know, that takes a different level of commitment to do that. So determining why you're doing it is super important. If you're just doing it to supplement your income, then it's fine. Like, a lot of it comes back to your business plan. Cause like in order to, if you're making a couple hundred grand already, you need to do a lot of activity to replace that in real estate, versus right. If you want to supplement your income, it's okay to do just a couple deals here and there then. Right. And maybe put that all back into real estate or your self-directed IRA or whatever you use for retirement, but not put yourself into so much pressure that you think that like, oh, I got to do 20 deals this year or anything like that. I don't know if that makes sense. But it
makes total sense. Yeah. Well, let's hone in on that strategy, because I think for most airline pilots, you know, we are busy flying. We've, you know, most people have families, they've got other social things, they've got hobbies. Yep. And so I think that for people listening to this specific episode that are interested in owning physical real estate, mm-hmm. in finding, analyzing, making offers, getting something and you know, building a real estate portfolio, I think that that's kind of the avenue, right? It's not, you know, I don't think many of our listeners are going to say, I'm going to go do 20 deals. Yep. But I think a lot will say, well, I'd love to own a few. Yep. And maybe once I own a few, I start investing more in syndications and things like that. So let's kind of dive into that strategy. Sure. How do you think someone that doesn't own anything yet, what's the best way for them to find their starter rental property, and why should they buy a starter rental property rather than, say, investing in a syndication from their first 50K?
So let's clarify. So for the purpose of the conversation, we're going to talk about their first rental property or whatever. We're going to say, let's just call it single family house, right? So yeah. That we can be on the same page, because the strategy doesn't change too much. It's just the operations might change a little bit. So if you're going to do a single family, then you got to say, all right, do you want a fixer or do you literally want like something turnkey? So do you want to find something that's messed up that you're going to have to put some dollars into to fix it up, make it worth more, force appreciation into the deal because you're fixing it up? Or do you want something that you can literally just dump 20% down on and get cash flow on it day one and hire a property manager and not deal with it? Or do you want a property manager? That's the other side. So that's the first side. Like, what are you choosing? And a lot of times what people do if they want to invest passively, they might choose something kind of in the middle where they maybe buy a rental that needs a little bit of lipstick to get it ready for renting. And then they hire a third-party manager to go rent it out for them and move on. I would highly encourage you not to find the tenant yourself if you can work that out. That's a different conversation on why. But essentially, if you're busy flying around, then the last phone call you want to have is screening applications for your tenants and dealing with all of that nonsense at the same time. So I'll go over some roadblocks really quick. Big speed bumps or whatever. Pitfalls. There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. Sorry.
Yeah.
Pitfalls. If you're going to go into a deal that requires any kind of rehab or construction, I don't know why. I've never been able to understand this, but I know some very successful business owners that have 40, 50, 80 employees. Yet when they buy their first house that needs rehab, for whatever reason, they throw all that experience out the window and they go do the rehab themselves. Like they physically go get tools and they feel like they have to go fix things themselves, right?
Right.
If you ever want to scale anything or actually be successful in this, I highly encourage you not to go do that. So I don't know, the DIY, for whatever reason with real estate, like we just feel like we got to go touch it, right?
Right.
Now, if you love doing that, different thing, right? But if you're doing it because you think you need to do it that way, not the right way to do it at all. And also one other side note, sorry, is that if the deal only works out because you're putting sweat equity into it, it's not a deal. Just something to throw out there too. But
that's a good point.
I can ramble on this stuff a lot. So
no, that is exactly what we're after here.
Rein me in wherever you need me to go.
That's money. Cause like, I think pilots were AMP mechanics on the side. We work on our airplanes. We're you know, engineers at heart, whatever we want to be. We're attorneys. We do all kinds of stuff. And I think, you know, we like to work on our own things and we like to do our own things. And it sometimes, you know, you got to get out of the mindset of I'm going to go hang sheetrock because I know how to hang sheetrock. It's like, okay, yep. You know how to hang sheetrock, but so does somebody else that can help you scale into whatever you're trying to do. And now you're going to be dependent on yourself and your days off and, you know, things like that. So, yeah.
And you can go pick up a double time trip for hundreds of dollars an hour and pay somebody else not hundreds of dollars an hour to do that. That's probably going to be better at it than you at the end of the day.
And I would encourage, here's my whole thing. If you love it, cool, go do it.
Right.
But I can promise you, you probably don't love all of it. So like I know some people that I've never actually, let me back up. I've never met anybody that loves all of it. I just want to throw that out there. So I have only had met a handful of investors, people that are full time that do a good job at doing the construction and running a business with it. Very, very few. And most of them that go out of the gate and they might be working on the project, they regret it at some point big time. And it may be because the deal goes south or they mess things up or it takes way longer than they thought it was going to and they just can't get to it. It becomes like, well, that's what I'm now doing on my weekends and nights and I don't see my family and this whole freaking thing. And a 3-month project turns into an 8-month project and yada, yada, yada. And then you just can't wait to get rid of that stupid house because it's been just a nightmare all the time. And your wife hates going there. Your kids hate going there, like all that stuff. So just, I've heard those stories more than anything. Now that said, let's say you do enjoy, I don't know, maybe you like flooring. Maybe you like doing basin trim and doors. Cool. Just go do that. Right. But sub everything else out if you enjoy it. And it is good to know construction. It absolutely is good to know those things. But knowing them in a way to check to see if your contractor is doing a good job or not is probably the better way. And how to communicate with them is also very like a way to not get burnt through change orders and all that type of stuff. Cause you know what you're talking about. That does help.
Right.
So,
okay. So I want to get to the construction aspect, but before we get there, I think what you're talking about, you know, not doing everything yourself, it's one of the feathers in the cap of investing out of state, which is something that I've always done because the real estate market that I personally live in isn't one that yields very high cash flow. And so when you're trying to build a real estate empire, if you live in a high priced city, you know, we say that the bigger pockets guys say this all the time, you know, you might have to go out of state. And it's actually David Green wrote a book, Long Distance Real Estate Investing, which talks about how, listen, it's not that big a deal to invest out of state because you really don't want to be doing all this stuff anyway. So let's talk about finding and analyzing a deal. You've obviously found and analyzed a lot more than even that 600 that you've done. How would you recommend people find a good market, find a good deal, and then analyze it?
Great. So the first question I always ask anybody, especially that's like, hey, how do I find a deal? I'd be like, well, what is a deal? And what's a deal to you? What does it actually look like? So you know what you're looking for. The wrong way is to say, so let's say I'm a realtor or a wholesaler. And a wholesaler is somebody that's literally actually just could be anybody that's sending direct marketing out and trying to find off-market properties. And then they want to sign them for a contract, sign them for a fee via contract. But realtors, wholesalers, whatever, you want to go do direct sourcing, doesn't matter. If you come up to me and let's say I'm a local broker in whatever city you're interested in, and you say, hey, I just want to find a deal that makes money. Cool. I'm never sending you anything because it's never going to, that's not specific enough. So what's the deal to you? Let's say I'm flipping a house. You know, our criteria was always 15% cash on cash return on the entire project. So that's if we bought the house cash and we did the rehab cash, then the total return needs to be at least 15% on the entire project. Now, once we add leverage, borrow money and so forth like that, yeah, it reduces the return, but that's a different leveraged return. That's very, very different, but allowed me to rate the risk of a property. If I was doing a buy and hold, what's your ideal cash on cash return? And if are you measuring it based off like a cap rate? Like, so you're saying that the whole deal gets an 8%, an 8 cap if you buy it all cash, let's just say, and depending on how it rents out, or are you doing it off of your own personal return on your 20% down or whatever you're putting down on the property, 25%, probably more likely these days, then what's your return on that? Like, what's important to you for that? So figure that out. And then how you're going to measure that criteria so you know what you're looking for. And when you find it, you know that you found it. The other aspects of it is that if you're are you going to be actively talking to sellers yourself? Or are you going to go outsource that to such as wholesalers, real estate agents, other people, whatever? I had to make a decision years ago that even though I've done plenty of direct sales, where I'm sending direct mailers, door knocking, whatever back in the day. And I also have had internally in the business people doing that for us as well. I had to make a commitment years ago that I'm an investment business, not an acquisitions business. and mm-hmm. which meant that I needed to focus more on the actual real estate that we're buying and less on sourcing the motivated seller. And that meant that I needed to go find other people to go do that, and they're third parties. So I was okay going with real estate brokers and wholesalers and so forth, even though I had internally somebody that was willing to go knock on doors, but I didn't rely on it. So right. that's the other delineation. Are you going to go find the deal, or are you going to go have other people do it for you? If I opened up a market tomorrow, which I used to, we were in 7 states at one point. If I was going to open up a new market that I've never been to at all, besides finding out what my criteria is and making sure it's the right market for me, like our age of the house important, is what's the average return? Is it a cash flow market or an appreciation market? All those things are
important. Let me ask you for someone who's like, I don't know how to figure that out. What are some resources that they can consume, books, podcasts, et cetera, that they can sort of hone in on what that would be for them?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of podcasts out there. Bigger Pockets Rookie Podcast is pretty good for like newbie stuff and analyzing mm-hmm. deals. You can literally Google that kind of stuff. Yep. Data's out there. Like there's tons of data. You guys probably know more about data than I do and where to find it. But it's really just figuring out what your criteria is and what's important to you for anything. Like if I was going to buy one house, I'm probably not as worried about the economic development and growth of that area as I would be if I'm going to go buy 50 houses in that area. Right. So you can probably figure that out a little bit easier thinking about one property that cash flows in an area that makes sense to you. The other aspect is like, you're not the one living there. But other people do. So it doesn't mean that you have to be willing to live in the house, right? Because maybe some of right. you guys might not want to live in the house that you're buying, right. but other people do, trust me. But going back to as well, like if you're going to open up a market and go find acquisitions, then you know, I would immediately like, I think too many people get too loyal to one real estate agent too soon. Unless they're bringing you deals regularly and working their butt off for you, like why have to be loyal to them? Do not sign an exclusive buyer's agreement. Just what that means is that a real estate agent is going to, especially a newer one that doesn't get it and has scarcity mentality, which is the wrong person, by the way. But if they send you an agreement to say, I'll search for houses for you, but I need you to just sign this little document, no big deal. Basically, all it means is that you can't use another agent. And if you do, you owe them a commission. So don't sign right. that shit. Sorry if I right. cursed.
No, you're fine.
I'll never forget the first time I met Tarl at a project. There was a real estate agent. And he showed up like 10 minutes late. And Tarl's like, fire that guy. I'm like, this guy, I'm just like such a nice guy. I don't want to fire him. And I had this attitude like, he's the only real estate agent on the planet because he's the only one that I know right now because I just got here to Seattle. And Tarl's like, fire him. And I looking back on it, it's like totally true. I had this, you get this mindset of like, there's only so many of them and I have to be so loyal to this one. I'm not saying be like reckless with relationships, but at the same time, just know that like there's a bigger universe out there with more people, right?
So. Yeah. But if I was opening up a new area, then I would go get 5, 6, 7 realtors. And I'd also go talk to other, I mean, maybe Screws Bigger Pockets and stuff or other local Facebook groups and see and meet other investors and talk to them, who's their agent, who's friendly, whatnot, and go interview all the agents. Of course, you got to get along with them, but they're going to ask you what your criteria is. So help figure that out. But you can ask them a ton of questions. If you're going to go buy rentals, go interview property management companies like crazy in that area and find out who's a good fit for you. Don't get tied to the first one. Trust me, it doesn't always work. And then additionally, the missing link, I think, is that a lot of people don't go after title or escrow enough, in my opinion. And now, depending on what state you're in, you might have closing attorneys or you might have escrow companies, right? So, or you might have both. Talk to them all. Find out who's the investor-friendly closing agents, right? Who's the investor-friendly escrow? Who's the investor-friendly title? And you can do that through networking on like local Facebook groups, local meetup groups, and Bigger Pockets for communities in those areas. And if you find out who those agents are, meaning title agents, escrow attorney closers, they know who's closing deals, right? And they know who's not. And they know who wholesalers are and they know who aren't. So in my opinion, that's been the secret of my success when I've opened up new markets is I immediately go after like who's the best title closers or escrows and all that kind of stuff that know investors. And then so that way I can vet people pretty quickly as far as who's the brokers that are closing, who's the wholesalers that aren't, that kind of thing.
I want to I want to break down exactly how you do that. So once you, when someone says XYZ title company, yep. How do you approach them? How, what does that process look like? And what does that conversation look like?
You just lie. You say you're going to buy hundreds of deals. No, I'm joking. Well, it depends on what you're trying to do. So to find the, you know, let's say we'll just use escrow or closing attorneys or whatever. It is important as an investor, in my opinion, to have a good closing escrow, right? Whether that's, like I said, I have to say, because you guys probably have more than one state that listens to you, but attorneys mm-hmm. in some states are the only people that can close. So it's important because especially if you're doing it out of state, you need to deal with people that like aren't ignorant closers, I guess, for lack of a better word. Like it's a big issue. So, but right. if I was kidding them up, I'd be like, hey, look, I plan on buying a handful of properties here. Like a lot of, think of that's backing up, sorry. A lot of escrow and title are dealing with one-time transactions. And a lot of times they're dealing with a realtor, which is why they're going after realtors and mortgage brokers and so forth, because they want that recurring, their client becomes that realtor, they become that mortgage broker because they can bring them consistent business. Now, if they're going direct all of a sudden where you're the one talking to them, then they'll be like, hey, I'm going to buy a couple deals a year and I'm just looking for somebody I can relate to and trust and I'm hoping that's you. Like, and then you can, but hopefully you're referred to them. They'll talk to you. They'll want to talk to you, especially if they like you. And then you can also say, I'm looking for people that maybe you like and trust. Who do you know that I can maybe work with that you want to give some business to? And preferably, do you know anybody that's wholesaling real estate right now and assigning contracts that's worth talking to that you like dealing with? Or is there anybody that is a broker that you know is crushing it or an investor that I can network with that you get repeat business from? You'd be surprised how they'll be like, oh yeah, cool. Let me make an introduction. Because they want...
That's a really great back door.
Yeah. It's been a huge part of my success.
To find great brokers.
Yep. Yeah. Some of the biggest deals I've ever gotten have come from relationships with title agents, basically. So, and relationships pay off.
It's incredible. That's something I haven't heard before.
Yep. Yeah. And you can find lenders that way too, right? So
absolutely.
The lenders are going to be yes. at the closing table as well. Actually, a business development rep, some title companies have business development reps who are trying to go out and find people like you to use their title and escrow company. Right. So if you find those people as well, they'll be like, open up the Rolodex to you big time.
Those are the big ones. Especially if you're in a state that has title agents that need to go find business, those are the ones that all their entire job is to go network and find people like you, right? And they want to give you everybody if they can, right? So that's the real key. I'll tell you right now, on another side, on a lender part, my escrow attorney, even though Washington doesn't require escrow attorney, I use an escrow attorney. She got me my best private money lender. And she did enough deals with me. And then she's just like, do you ever need more money? I'm like, yes. And then she's like, I have a client. And then, you know, literally within 30 days of me and this guy, I owed him $4.5 million. So it's like, I was like, ah, that's great. I like this guy. Thank you. And I still talk to him.
That's amazing.
That was in 2015. But so network with that. Know what you're looking for. The cream rises to the top. So maybe you find 5, 6, 7, 8 realtors and wholesalers. Two side notes. There's a big difference between a wholesaler and a realtor, but I'll get to that in a second and how you handle them. But you maybe see you get 5, 6, 7 realtors that you like and you're talking to and they're sending you stuff. You got to answer them. You got to respond back. You got to ask questions. You got to reply to their emails or else they're going to ignore you later, right? Now, if somebody's just sending you junk all the time, you need to tell them why, right? That you're not liking this stuff. This isn't what it is. And they'll hone it in. I'm looking for the motivated one that wants to send me stuff, like is excited. And they might not be the best, right? But they can be. And so, and they're good to work with. And are they somebody I would have a beer with when I'm in town? So those are all things that I'm looking for. And maybe out of that 5 or 7 of them, maybe 1 or 2 like rise to the top and are actually delivering and they're actually making sense and they want to work with me and figure it out. Perfect. I'm going to hold on to those two. And if I flip houses, one of them's getting the listings. So, and then they really want to work with you at that point. Wholesalers, think about this. Most wholesalers are somebody that went to a seminar, read a book, did something, and they either are doing it professionally, which means they like are putting $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a month into marketing. So they're running a business, or they're doing it super part-time on the side, working a job, and maybe they're door knocking, sending maybe $500 of mailers or whatever. So the professional ones are gonna have tighter margins a lot of the times. But they're really good, right? And they're really good as a business. Doesn't mean their deals are really good. And they usually have a short list. So you just got to build that relationship. On another note, the newer wholesalers, you got to go find a lot of them because there's a good chance they're not finding a deal. So it's a wide net. But
real quick, for anybody who's just never heard of the term wholesaler before, how would you identify one if you came across them?
They call themselves a wholesaler, but that doesn't mean they are, by the way. That just means that they're calling themselves
a... I'm kind of backing into, bandit signs, we buy homes, bandit cash, signs. That kind of thing, right?
That's actually a good way to do it too. You could find, bandit signs, that's good. If you see any signs out there that say, buy your house cash, that's typically a wholesaler. You can call that sign and just be like, what up? And then I'm a buyer. Mm-hmm. Like, you got a buyer's list you can put me on? Chances are they don't, because they probably have never done a deal before, but you never know. Maybe they do, but I'm being facetious or whatever the word is, but the
person that answers is like their VA or something, like in Malaysia. Totally. I mean, that could be,
absolutely true. But you got to network with wholesalers. Some of the best deals I've ever gotten, if not most of the best deals I've ever gotten, have come from wholesalers, but you have to have a wide net, and you have to talk to a lot of them. And you have to consistently talk to them, because a wholesaler, if they are like a newer one, for instance, or maybe somebody that does maybe only a couple deals a year, as soon as they have that deal, it's a hot potato and they wanted to send it to somebody. And it's usually going to be the last person they talk to, not somebody that they talk to once every month. So, touching base with them, and it becomes basically our acquisitions became relationships. Like, we had spreadsheets on wholesalers. And we would like have almost recurring text messages, follow-ups. I literally hired somebody on my team just to go network with wholesalers, and that was it. And then
that's amazing.
That's how we built it.
What's the worst thing that's happened flipping a house? Tell us the story.
Losing a ton of money. That's the worst thing. I've had like very, very, very stressful moments that are like, oh, this guy's falling, but nothing's worse than me than like, we had a deal last year when the market shifted. I thought we only lost like 75 grand, but we didn't. We lost like 96. So that sucks. All right. So, but that at the end of the day, that's just, it sucks if that's all your money. But if you're also like, well, I didn't make a ton of other money on this, this just becomes part of the business, right?
Well, you're taking a lot of swings, right? Like you're throwing a lot of pitches. You're swinging the bat. It's not like this is the one deal you did all year, right? So like, that's the thing. It's like, if you're doing more deals, you probably have a higher probability of maybe one going not as great. And that's just the nature of it, right?
Especially when, it's Kirkland, Washington, and it drops super dramatically in the summer last year. It sold for what we wanted. No, it didn't. Sorry. It sold for $150,000 less than what it projected for. What's kind of funny is that we bought it thinking it was going to sell for 1.35. And then a month after we bought it, that same street, the comps went to 1.6, and then it sold for 1.2. And like, this is all within like a 6 month period. Like, it was insane. Ryan knows, he lives in Seattle. So crazy markets. But that said, it sucked. But that's not the worst thing by any means. Some of the worst things, really almost all of it involves, what happens with construction, rehab, city ordinances, all that kind of stuff that kind of change on you sometimes. And, what a permit department all of a sudden wants out of nowhere. Or, I remember, it's hard for me to answer this, Ryan, just because like in that moment, it was the worst thing. And then looking back, I'm like, oh, I've had way worse now. Or like, whatever. Like, so it's like, depends on what level I was at. So like a level 6 problem today is like, whatever, that's like every day. But then when I was a level 4 leader, like, it was like, this guy's falling. So we had one video that got sent to me. This one was fun. We have a video, I think it's on my Instagram actually, but a video that was sent to me one time by a contractor that all I see is I'm like, that's one of my houses. And he's yanking on like a cable, and then the ceiling to the entire kitchen just collapses. Like the entire, and you're talking like not a little kitchen, huge, like literally everything, framing and all, not like the sheetrock. I mean like, all of it, including the support, the joist, the ceiling joist, all of it just collapses. And he goes, it's a great video. It's on my Instagram. Like, it just says, that was the kitchen ceiling. That's all the voice says on it. And I'm like, what the hell is this? So that's a great video to get. That entire house, believe it or not, this is where you see like homeowner specials. Like, that was a homeowner remodeled house that was hard to find out through the inspection because it was a hoarder house. So we had 460 something tires on that property that were like, we had to remove. something like it was like 457 or 467. But and when that ceiling collapsed, because people were somebody in the last 50 years were moving walls around and sheetrocking, but forgot that there's loads on houses, like load bearing walls, and they didn't really care about those for whatever reason, and they just moved walls everywhere. So that's why the ceiling collapsed when my contractor cut the knob and tube electrical wire on it. The knob and tube electrical wire is what was holding up the framing in the ceiling joists. And when I finally showed up to this property, it was an A-frame style house. And in an A-frame, that's where, you know, it's basically just a peak, like a ridge pointing up. The house was splitting in half. It had no more shear, so like shear protection. So you can actually see the skylight, so the sky as the house in the middle of the A, like the peak of it was separating because the house started separating. So that sucked. I've had houses burned down, which actually in the moment that the house was burned down, I was in I was at a jiu-jitsu immersion camp in Maine with no signal. And I finally got signal and I see a text message from my team going like, "Hey, where's the insurance policy for blah, blah, blah street?" My team, I didn't even know my team knew we had insurance. Like, I'm like, nobody's ever asked me this. Something's wrong. And I find out that the house burned down. And I'm like, well, crap, do we have insurance on this? I hope so. Because sometimes you close on a house and you forget a few weeks and to get the insurance. But and we had insurance. Now, at that moment, it sucked. But then when we got our insurance check and we sold the dirt for as much as we bought the house for, we're like, wow, that's actually the best flip we've ever done, right? I think we made like 280 on the thing. It was amazing. It was like, I'm like, I want them all to burn. Like, it's great.
But, I was on a layover and I landed in Hawaii. It was like really late on the East Coast, obviously. And we're getting to dinner with the captain and I get this voicemail. It pops up on my phone and I look at it and the guy is going, "Ryan, your project's on fire." And I was just thinking, yeah, it looks really good. Looks great, you know? And I was like, oh, it's burning down. but you know, I want to hone in on that because all this stuff can go wrong and it will wrong is the reality, right? We get into investing, things are going to go wrong. If you're an active investor, things are going to go get wrong. But Taro, I've been to your properties and I've walked job sites with you. And one thing that I really love is like you have someone that goes by and like takes pictures for you. You have a system of where you put them on Google Drive, and you've got sort of this process in place to handle this stuff. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. I'll tell you later for a different time, but I have some really bad stories that I just popped in my head. Make me go down memory lane of, I'm really depressed now, actually. Thanks guys.
This is real estate therapy.
Right. Sorry. I thought at one of my events, I'm like, we should just have a panel and just have a bunch of, you know, hardcore investors go up there and just about their worst moments and just let us just like vent to everybody in the crowd. It might be fun. Who knows? But as far as the answer to your question on that, one of the first systems and processes are very, very important. You guys are all pilots. You guys know that checklists, everything. It's what you guys live, die by. Not that I know anything about that. I've never flown a plane, but I did go do a 1 hour thing on a helicopter one time where they let me touch the collector, but, collective, whatever it's called.
That's it.
There you go. but that said, processes and systems are everything. It starts with day one. So for me, you know, pictures was a big deal. I'd rather have 100 photos of a property than a video of a property. And the reason for that is that a video might tell you the flow, right? But it won't really tell you what's wrong with it. So pictures, especially if you take pictures the right way, it allows you to see a lot of the deal and it makes it to where you never have to come back to the deal again if you take the pictures correctly. So I think those are super important. But then the question is where you put the pictures. So there's a couple of things that allowed me to scale. And if I had a list, one of the, you know, the top five pictures is definitely up there. And we use Dropbox. You can use Google Drive, doesn't matter. But if you're going to go walk a property, then why not do everything you need to do to get the data you need from that first walk day one within the first hour? So if you can't spend 6 hours at the property, then cool, spend 30 minutes just taking photos. And then that way you can go back to your house or wherever you're good to go, your office, and look at the 100, 200 photos that you had in detail to really like analyze and figure out if this is right for you. You can also, what's great is that if you're not there and you're out of state, you can send somebody else to take all the photos for you, which is even better. Right. But they need to put them in Dropbox, Google Drive, label them correctly. What we then did, like we do that for every purchase. Doesn't even matter if we're never going to buy the property. We might not, we don't know if we're going to buy the property or not. We still take those photos and they're very, very important. Now, during the projects, right, and we're doing our normal rehabs and so forth, like it sucks having to drive the property all the time, right? And at least some of you guys might like it. I don't know. I don't like it. So instead we would take photos. So I would send at least one person once a week to the property. And if it was me, then I would take the photos, but like I would take somebody out there and they would take 100 photos of the property every single week and then put it in a Dropbox folder labeled to the property with today's date, what was going on in the property. And it could be the word drywall, cabinets, something. And then the name of the person who took the photo. Now you don't need to do that if you're the only one taking the photos, but, and we would make a folder for that. And then you see, okay, well it's May 10th, right? 2023 drywall. That's it. And then you dump all the pictures of that day in there. So fast forward 2-3 months later, you lost a electrical outlet. Nobody could find it because the sheetrocker sheetrocked over it. Cool. You go back to your photos that you take every week and you see drywall. All right, cool. Let me click on that folder and look at all the photos of what the house used to look like before drywall. And so, and then go find that outlet. So now you don't have somebody cutting your walls up everywhere. So little, I could talk forever about why pictures have saved us probably millions over the years, just from construction challenges, but also, being able to check on the houses in case like people break in. The 1 week that we don't take pictures is always the week that somebody broke in or lives in the house or something bad happened or a water pipe burst or something. It's always the week we didn't go to the house. So go to it every week. But that's just one small
system. The lien waiver you don't get signed is always the one that has a claim. Yep. Yep. It's just how the world works. So
can we talk a little bit about, all right, we've talked about, you know, finding, analyzing, walkthroughs, some construction. If you find something you like, what's your method for making offers and taking a deal down and lending and things like that?
That's a good question. So have your due diligence checklist for one, so you know if it's a good deal or not. Everybody's got to have a different one. We have ours, right? But have your due diligence list, know what that is. And then when it comes to offers, just know what, you know, I guess backing up, do you have your max offer price, right, that you can put out there? But you don't always have to open up with that. Like in today's market, depending on what you're buying and where you're buying, you might be able to get some lowball offers out there and see it. But I think the biggest advice I can give on this is that don't fall in love with that one deal, especially if it's single family. Right. Know that like even if you get your offer accepted, doesn't mean you're going to buy it because you still might need to inspect it and some other things. You got to have a large net out there and you got to put offers out because if you're going to put, let's say you are only going to put one offer out, sorry, you're only going to want to buy one property. That doesn't mean you do it one at a time, right? Right. You know, you might need to go put out 5, 10, 15, 20 offers at one time. And you might ask yourself, well, what if they all get accepted? Well, that's the best thing about this business is you can back out of all of them. So, and just buy the one that you had. You have inspection clauses or you have some other, there's tons of clauses out there you can put into a contract that allows you to back out without any, you know, issues to you. And right. So I would highly encourage that. Most people aren't going to find the deal they're looking for by putting one offer out. It's just not, it's very, very, very uncommon. And lucky people sometimes get it, but whatever. But once you get your offer accepted, then, you know, then you do your final due diligence before you release any earnest money or you release any of your contingencies and so forth before you go to close. And then it's going to go to an escrow title company or whatever and get that cleared up. And then when it comes to lending, having your lender secured or your way to finance the deal, whether it's personal or otherwise, is something that you typically want to figure out before you are coming to the closing table. So networking with, like, I run a hard money company, other people, there's plenty of hard money companies out there. And if you're looking for hard money, if you're looking for permanent financing, it's really important that you know what those terms are going to look like, but also what the timeline is going to be. If you're going to go to a local credit union to get an investor loan, right, but you do a 2-week close, Well, most credit unions need 30 to 45 days to close on any kind of long-term financing. So now you've just shot yourself in the foot. Yeah, but the offer got accepted because it's 2 week close. Like, yeah, but you can't close. So that's so kind of knowing that aspect is probably one of the most important parts. Now, can people close cash and then refinance, you know, afterwards and do what's called a delayed closing? Or I think it's something, I can't remember what it's called. Never mind. Delayed.
Oh, good.
Delayed closing for the lender. Sorry. That's what it would be called. But you could do that, right? And but not everybody does it. Yeah. So some lenders allow like a delayed closing, which maybe you close cash on the deal, but then you can refi quickly to be able to get your cash back out, but not have to wait to season the deal. So then seasoning, a lot of times you don't get cash out refinance unless you've owned a property for 6 to 12 months, depending on the lender. So some lenders, if you're working with them in advance, they might go like, yeah, you can go close cash. And then we can, you know, if you, as long as you close with us within like 2 weeks or whatever, or 3 or 4 weeks of whatever you buy the property, they'll treat it as if it was a purchase and get you cashed out. Not every lender does that. So you got to find that out first. Don't plan on it and then have it not happen. Those are all big things. And DSCR loans, debt service coverage ratio loans are out there. A lot of you guys are pilots, so you might be able to still qualify for your Fannie Freddie stuff. Make sure you have that stuff buttoned up first before you go out there and start buying, so you know you could afford. There's so many opportunities out there with it.
I find that lending is another one of those where you got to cast a really wide net, because some lenders are investor friendly. Some lenders will lend to out-of-state buyers where others won't. You know, the landscape is very vast and it's not standardized in any way.
It's getting smaller, though.
If you jump back to our episode 16 with Clint Coons, make sure that your structure doesn't get in the way of your financing. And you'll know what I mean when you listen to that podcast. Yes. But we covered that in detail, where you can get so overly creative with your LLCs that no lender is going to want to touch you, especially for FHA. You can't do it. So just make sure that you've got your business strategy in place if you're going to go that route.
Yeah, I'm gonna one quick 30-second thing on that. Like, I actually got asked this the other day. I was at a conference and the person was so obsessed with LLCs, and I'm like, have you ever even put an offer out yet? Like, just the so it's and he's like, no. I'm like, all right, let's start with that. Like, so I believe that you can do a lot of great things with just like one entity, and then you can always add on and get more complicated the more complicated your asset protection is needs. So don't go crazy with it day one, because it can not be a good thing for you later if you set it up wrong, and you might hate it later. So like Ryan said, but yeah, just something to think about.
I love that.
Let's shift gears here to your event. You know, Tarl, like I said in the beginning, I get a lot of value out of your events, your meetups. It's how I got connected. You know, if you're thinking about how to find deals, like, you find great meetups. And one of the ways that I got connected into Seattle was I went to your meetups, and your meetups turned into kind of a big national stage wealth expo. And now you have a lot of great speakers. I was just kind of surfing your speakers list, like Robert Kiyosaki and Brandon Turner and
Ken McElroy.
I mean, like, his book, ABCs of Real Estate Investing, was like one of the first books I read when learning how to invest in commercial real estate. And like, he has got a tremendous company and a podcast and just really good. So speak to us about the event. What's it all about? Who's it for?
Yeah, we even have Chris Voss, Never Split the Difference.
Saw that.
Great book.
Nice. Yeah.
George Gammon. Yeah,
book, Never Split the Difference, Chris Voss. I mean, if you talk about negotiating for a project, that's a great book to read. So.
Yeah, just a side note on that. The only reason why we're talking about meetups too is like, it comes to networking. Like, Seattle, when I was really growing my business, I didn't like any of our like networking meetups. Like, I mean, I would go to them and I'd be like, man, these aren't, basically one would be like a pitch fest. The other one would just be like hang out and drink, which was fun. That was my favorite one to go to, but like, it wasn't really what I wanted. So I pissed off my team and said, we're going to do a meetup. And then we had 110 people show up to the first one. I'm like, oh, I guess people like this, so we should probably do more. And it grew and grew. And then, but in reality, all I did was like, I'm just going to create what I want to go to. And I was doing it to network. Like, I wanted to go meet other wholesalers, and I wanted to go meet other investors, and I wanted to go meet other people. And like, I would never shy away from networking. Like, if you know, some people say there's a guy in our market, James Standard, great guy. You could look at him and go like, he's competition, right? To me. Right. But in reality, like I've probably bought 36, 37 deals from that guy. And if the crap hit the fan tomorrow, he's one of the first people I would probably call. Right. Yeah. And so there's networking with other investors is super important because nobody else really Definitely. Relates to what you're doing. And in that case, and they can refer you to so many people. If they won't refer you to people, they're the wrong. They're not a cool person to hang out with. So don't do it.
It's a team sport.
It is a team sport. But yeah, to that point, like I don't know what's wrong with me, but we started doing bigger events. It's not like they're that profitable. but if anything, it might have hurt my business doing these things. But you know, I guess at the end of the day, I get to meet all these people that go on stage, and that has led to some amazing relationships, which is why we do it. But so we created an event called Limitless Expo. So it's www.limitlessexpo.com. So Ken McElroy, if you don't know him, he has over $2 billion in real estate, and he wrote the book on ABCs of real estate investing. And he was part of the Rich Dad Advisors for a long time with Robert Kiyosaki, and just a great, great dude. I met him at my expo in 2019 in Seattle because he came out and spoke, and we became really, really good friends pretty quick. And then COVID happened and we shut everything down, blah, 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 as far as the events company goes. And I was with Ken in Laguna in 2022, last year. Shoot, it wasn't even that long ago. And we're just BSing, and I was complaining about how like my team wants to do the expo again. And I'm like, man, I don't know. And he had this idea of doing more of a financial freedom, financial independence, like business, entrepreneurship, and real estate conference, because money and finance and economy changes all the time, and what the best investment vehicle is in the world changes regularly. So we came up with this idea of Limitless. And within 4 months later, we had 1,300 people at this conference. And massive speakers, plus also a huge exhibitor area for vendors and so forth that are all vetted out. And we don't allow sales from the stage, right? It was just basically me and Ken going like, who do we want to learn from? Who do we want to be around? And who do we want to grow? Like, and you know, especially today, the economy, like with what the hell is going on out there, bank failures, bricks, the dollar, which is almost like toilet paper right now, potentially yeah. as it's going. What the hell do you do? Right. So that's what Limitless is. It is the place that these answers are answered. And it's also where networking is all about. We'll have over 50 speakers, 65 exhibitors, and they're all vetted by me and Ken. Ken and I don't need to do this. We don't, you know, we don't have anybody on the stage that's paid. Everybody's there because they want to be there. Everybody's there because they want to learn, including the speakers, and they're out walking about, you know, just like everybody else. And we're all networking. So it's the event that I want to go to, which is what we create, because I'm looking for these answers. So that's why we do it. That's why I still do it. You know, if I wanted to do everything just for money, I would just go keep doing investing in real estate. But this is definitely a big thing for us. So I think it's a big thing for everybody, because there's a lot of negativity out there right now in the world. And we also raise money for charity at the event. So we do a lot of, the only sales from the stage is we do charity auctions, and we'll probably raise at least $500,000 this year at this event that goes to two organizations that I believe in big time. So
I've donated charity flights to those events numerous times, and have had a blast with the people I take around. So
big support.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
where is it? When is it? How do people find about it?
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. That's probably important, right? It's June 15, 16, 17. The main conference is on 16, 17th of June. The expo portion is 15. Actually, it's all 3 days, but it starts on the 15th. Limitlessexpo.com. It's in Scottsdale, Arizona at the JW Desert Ridge. And if you use the discount code TARL, T-A-R-L, 20, you'll get 20% off. Brings it back down to our early bird ticket price. For everybody. Amazing. Tickets are on track. We did sell out last year. So we're only supposed to have 1200 people there max, and we had 1300 people. So we kind of messed up there a little bit, but there is a virtual element this year. And the virtual side is way better than you think it is. We've gotten really good at that portion of it. So if you can't make it in person, there's a virtual side to it. And for in person, lots of parties, lots of networking, tons of content, and lots of amazing people.
Incredible. Great.
Ryan. Well, our listeners wanted to get in touch with you, Tarl. How would they do that?
Well, let's see.
Instagram is always good. I can put out your cell phone number.
Why not? Instagram, if you just want to, like, you know, chat, BS, that kind of stuff. Tarl Yarber, T-A-R-L, last name Yarber, Y-A-R-B-E-R. I will give out my lending email, so we'll do that. The Tarl at Fixated Funding, if you are looking for hard money, that is there. But the there's also Tarl at Limitless Expo, but nobody looks at that email, so have fun with that one.
And I just want to finish this before we sign off with the burr, a quick 2-3 minutes on the burr strategy. And if you're looking for hard money to close a deal, burr it, season it, and then get and then put permanent financing on it. I know you're a big fan of the burr. I am too. So you can just break that down, and we'll leave it with that.
Yeah. So quick side note, I think that burrs, burrs are very, very dependent on lending and how to do it correctly. And with interest rates going up and the market being volatile, then you really need to structure your purchase pretty accurately, like in my opinion, like or else you're going to not be very happy on the back end. So everything about a burr, buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat is ultimately the end portion, which is the refinance portion of it. And then you got to make sure the cash flows. So you can still refi, but like right now rents might be going up, but they're stabilizing in some areas. So keep that in mind. And rates are going up, but they might fluctuate. Who knows? So that, you know, you really got to pay attention to that if you're going to do that correctly on the purchase side these days. That said, here's my entire belief on burrs. It's a flip. The only difference is you keep it. So for not everybody agrees with this. I agree with it because I'm saying it, I guess. Not every flip is a good burr, but every good burr has to be a good flip. And it doesn't make sense. So I believe that fully. And if some people are like, no, it doesn't need to be a good flip, I'm like, well, then it's just a buy and hold. It's not a burr at that point. Right. But besides point. Way I structure my deals to not have to worry about seasoning is even if I have the cash to buy it, I purposely structure my purchase to be with private money lenders. So these are people that I've met, talked to over the years, and they have liquid capital to invest with me. So I give them a note, 8-10%, depending on who they are, and I fund the deal with their note in a first position. And that also includes the rehab. So I might do I don't do seconds typically, but like I usually get it all on one first. The reason why I do that is so that when I go to refinance later, if I've hit my rehab budget and I've done it all correctly, I don't need to wait to season my loan or worry about a 75% cash out because the entire deal, all my money is in that private lender note on the first. So that when I go to refinance, it's a rate refinance and not a cash out refi. And that's worked really, really well for me. So I've been able to burr pretty quick doing it that way. Now there is a catch. If you don't know what you're doing and you take 100% financing on the front end with private money and stuff like that, and on the back end, all of a sudden the appraisal's 50 grand less than you thought it was going to be. And you went 20 grand over budget. Guess who's owing a ton of money to somebody. And your reputation and all that stuff. And if it's your grandma's money, so don't do that. Make sure you know what you're doing if you want to go that level. But that said, it's definitely, there's a lot of cool creative ways to structure it to make it work out and faster for you if you're going to scale this thing up.
There's also tax advantages, and we won't go into that because we're at the end here, but if episode 10 of Passive Income Pilots, we dive into that, and episode 14, we even go even deeper into it. So if you want to know the tax benefits of holding property versus selling it, we go way into that. So there's additional benefits to just cashing out your money and losing that asset that may appreciate over time.
I would say honestly, like flipping houses, a lot of taxes. And especially if you're doing it on a side and you're not a professional, like a real estate professional with it. So, which is a tax designation. So, keep that in mind too. Like if you're already a high income earner and you start flipping houses, like you might be an even higher income earner and pay a ton of taxes on those flips. Right. So you might be like, why did I do this? I didn't make any money. Versus buying holds and rentals, like you're going to like that depreciation over time. So,
yeah.
Heck yeah. Tarl, thank you so much for coming on. Ton of value. Hopefully we can maybe get you on sometime in the future to do a deep dive on one of these subjects.
It'd be awesome.
Good seeing you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You're welcome.
Appreciate y'all.
All right. Cheers, guys. We'll take us out, and we appreciate it. Take care.